I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, voters are heading to the polls in Egypt to choose a new president. We wanted to know more about who's running and how voters are reacting to what observers are calling the first truly competitive elections in the country's history. We'll talk with the correspondent who's covering this in just a few minutes. But first, we turn to presidential politics in this country. The Obama campaign has taken to the airwaves to attack Mitt Romney, this time leading the asset management firm Bain Capital. But the strategy has been hit by friendly fire. This comes in a week that showed the Obama-Romney matchup as the close race it was long expected to be. We wanted to talk more about that, so we've called two of our regular political commentators. Mary Kate Carey is a former speechwriter for President George H.W. Bush. She's now a columnist and blogger for U.S. News and World Report. Also with us, Cynthia Tucker. She is a professor of journalism at the University of Georgia. She's also a Pulitzer Prize winner for her work at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Ladies, it's great to have you both back with us.
Great to be here.
Good to be here, Michelle.
So let's start off with that exciting contretemps involving Newark Mayor Cory Booker. The Obama campaign has been attacking Mitt Romney's time at Bain Capital, saying the company slashed benefits and jobs at a steel mill that it bought. Now, I do think it's worth mentioning that this is a line of attack that was originated by Republicans during the primary. I think that's worth noting. But this weekend, when Newark, New Jersey mayor and Obama surrogate Cory Booker went on Meet the Press, he criticized the attack, saying it's nauseating to the American people. Enough is enough, and it took almost no time for the Romney campaign to use Booker's words to their advantage. Here's a clip in a new online ad. Here it is.
Have you had enough of President Obama's attacks on free enterprise? His own key supporters have. Democrat Mayor Cory Booker of New Jersey.
I have to just say from a very personal level, I'm not about to sit here and indict private equity.
Okay, worth noting, Booker criticized both campaigns on Meet the Press, and he criticized attempts to revive President Obama's association with former pastor, the Reverend Jeremiah Wright. But, Mary Kate, I have to ask you, what do you think? I mean, what struck you about this? I'm particularly curious about your time as in the Bush White House. Like, what would you have done if one of your surrogates went on and kind of upended one of your campaign themes?
Back in the day, back in ancient history, the 1988 campaign, Bush versus Dukakis, I was the senior writer. And most of, not speechwriter, but regular writer. And most of my stuff went out to the surrogates. So I worked very closely with the surrogate office there. And I wrote something every day that was the campaign's position on whatever the news of the day was, so that the surrogates knew exactly where the campaign stood. We certainly didn't expect them to agree with everything, but they were expected to know what our position was. And if they chose to disagree, that was fine. If this had happened now, I don't think there would have been this massive overreaction by the campaign to take this guy to the woodshed and walk everything back and have him cut a new video explaining his position. It turned it into a one-day story into a four-day story. Here it is Wednesday, and we're still talking about it. The video's on the internet. It was really—
You think they should have said he's entitled to his opinion?
Yeah,
and
they
guess what?
Said,
these are his constituents.
Right.
So, of course, he's going to defend it. But
they should have said he was over his skis, so to speak, and let it go, because I just think that was a massive mishandling by the Obama campaign. They should have said agree to disagree.
Cynthia Tucker, what do you say?
Well, I think there's a good reason that Mary Kate didn't have any experience with this in the Bush White House. There's a big difference between Democrats and Republicans in terms of behavior. And this is that big difference. You know, Will Rogers said a long time ago, I belong to no organized political party. I'm a Democrat. Republicans simply don't do that. They don't get off message that way.
We obey.
But the line about Republicans is we don't fall in love, we fall in line. And you see that Republicans are doing that behind Mitt Romney. So partly what you're seeing here is the difference, a difference in the DNA in Democratic operatives and Republican operatives. But let me also make a comment about overreaction. Mary Kate may be right that the Obama administration overreacted, but I think the Republicans have also overreacted. I think they went one or two steps so far because they quickly got ads together using not only Cory Booker, but there were a couple of other Democrats who challenged Obama on his attacks on Bain Capital. One of those was Steve Rattner, a big-time Democrat who's also run a private equity company, and he has a piece in the New York Times hammering Mitt Romney for his stewardship of Bain Capital in terms of job creation. He says that Mitt Romney has vastly exaggerated the number of jobs that he created while he was at Bain Capital, and that that's fair game. So I don't think that this has necessarily worked to the Republicans' advantage either.
But has you, do you think that the damage has attached to the Obama strategy to use this? I mean, the president has said that he still thinks that this is a legitimate argument, that Mitt Romney is using his time at Bain Capital as his credential, that it is fair to examine his record. Do you think that that argument still holds force, that it's still a good one?
I absolutely do. Not only did the president say it was legitimate, Michelle, he came out and said this will be at the center of the campaign because this is the credential that Mitt Romney has chosen to make the centerpiece. I am qualified to be commander-in-chief because I know how to write the economy, because I created jobs when I was at Bain Capital. So Obama said that will be at the center of the campaign, and I suspect it will. Let me also say that this notion that Obama is trying to use of turning what Mitt Romney thought would be a strength, his experience at Bain Capital, into a weakness is right out of the Republican playbook. If you remember 2004, John Kerry put forth his military credentials as the centerpiece of his campaign, and Karl Rove and company quickly turned that into a weakness for him. Obama is trying to do exactly the same thing with these attacks on Bain Capital.
I'm talking politics with two of our regular political commentators. Cynthia Tucker is a professor of journalism at the University of Georgia and a Pulitzer Prize winner. Mary Kate Carey is a former speechwriter for President George H.W. Bush, now a columnist and blogger for U.S. News and World Report. So, Mary Kate, I know that the polls are interesting to you, too, on the, to Cynthia's point that this is a core issue. It's always been expected to be a key issue, is it? Are the polls showing that it is the economy? Who is best positioned to handle the economy? What are the polls saying?
Yeah, I agree that this is not a distraction, this argument about Bain Capital. It goes to the heart of the way people feel about capitalism and free markets. There were two polls that came out in the last 24 hours. ABC Washington Post poll, the key number in that one is that 30% of those polled think they are worse off since they were in 2008. Which is very similar to my old boss, President Bush 41's numbers right before he was going into the election. And that is not a good sign for Obama. And then the NBC Wall Street Journal poll, 2/3 of those polled think we're on the wrong track, and more than half disapprove of the president's handling of the economy. Those numbers go even higher than the half of disapproval numbers among independents, women, and working class voters. Those are very bad numbers for the Obama White House, and I think they should be hitting the panic button. The most interesting thing, aside from the economy, is the president had a 19-point lead among women in April under the ABC Post poll. That's down to a 7-point lead. So Romney's definitely making some great headway amongst women. And I think this argument on the Catholic Church has a lot to do with it.
Really? And Cynthia, how do you read that data?
Well, I don't. First of all, I think to Mary Kate's point about the president's fairly weak poll numbers on the economy, that's no great surprise. I don't think the Obama administration is hitting the panic button because they knew that they would be fighting a battle in a very tough economic climate. And voters always vote on pocketbook issues. And last year, they understood that the unemployment numbers weren't going to be nearly as good as they had hoped. So this is going to be a very tight election, very closely fought. Having said that, let me say that, first of all, different polls show different numbers on the gender gap. Some polls show it having closed significantly for Romney. Some polls show that the president still has a 12 to 13 point advantage among women over Romney. So that's going to be a key group that both men will continue to battle over and for. But the other thing that I think is significant here is, you know, we love to talk about national polls, the head-to-head matchup in national surveys, but those really aren't the poll numbers that matter most. This election is going to be won or lost for Obama in 8 or 9 pivotal swing states. And it is those poll numbers that are going to be the most interesting. And at the moment, the best news for Romney is that one poll shows him up in Florida. However, there are other polls that show that the economy is improving in states like Ohio, and in Pennsylvania, Obama is up. So those are state polls critical in critical battleground areas that I think are more important to watch.
But some of those critical battleground areas also have Republican governors now who are obviously very supportive of Mitt Romney, like Virginia, for example, which Obama won, Ohio, which Obama won. And so those are clearly – okay, those are clearly going to be places to watch. Mary Kate, we only have a minute left. What are the next places that you think we should be turning our attention to? Cynthia says it's those battleground states. What do you say? What are the places, the next places to look?
I would agree with that. I think battleground states, it's a dwindling handful of people in a smaller and smaller number of states that are going to be key here. The most interesting thing this week was the Catholic lawsuit against the president. 43 Catholic institutions filed federal lawsuits against the president. And many of those were in swing states and major media markets with a key core constituency of white working class Catholics. And I think that could make quite a difference in terms of turnout.
Mary Kay Carey is a former speechwriter for President George H.W. Bush. She's a columnist and blogger for U.S. News and World Report. She was here with us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Cynthia Tucker is a professor of journalism at the University of Georgia. She was with us from member station WCLK in Atlanta. Ladies, thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up today marks an historic moment for Egyptians. It's their first presidential election since the uprising that ousted Hosni Mubarak last year. Some argue it's actually the first free and fair election in the nation's history. We'll hear more about who is running and what voters are saying in a few minutes. But first, we want to talk about a historic announcement from the venerable civil rights organization, the NAACP. America's oldest and largest civil rights group now officially supports same-sex marriage rights. The NAACP recently passed a resolution opposing any policy or legislative initiative that, quote, seeks to codify discrimination or hatred into the law or to remove the constitutional rights of LGBT citizens, unquote. That position may put the organization at odds with many African Americans. According to a recent poll by the Pew Research Center, 49% of Black Americans oppose same-sex marriage rights. We wanted to talk more about this, so we've called upon the NAACP's chairman, Emeritus Julian Bond. He's also a well-known and respected civil rights leader. He's here with us in our Washington, D.C. studio. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us once again.
My pleasure.
Just to clarify, this has not been a personal struggle for you, as I recall. You know, in previous conversations you and I have had, you've never expressed any concern about marriage equality yourself.
No, it's long been an article of faith with me that equality means equality, and if we're all going to be equal in America, being able to marry is one of the equal things all of us need.
The organization, though, on the whole, has not previously taken up this issue, although there was, I think, a march in 1993, an LGBT rights march that the organization supported.
We supported it. Our chairman at the time attended it. So did several of our staff members, and the board voted unanimously to support it. I was on the board then, and I tell you, frankly, I don't remember this, so it probably wasn't on my radar screen as much as it ought to have been, but it shows that we're not Johnny-come-latelys to this fight.
But this announcement is being seen as a big deal. Do you think it's a big deal?
I think it's a big deal. I think we're the first majority Black civil rights organization to say what we said. I think if you look at the changing polls figures over time, the numbers and percentages of Black Americans who support fairness and justice is growing rather than shrinking, and we're in the vanguard.
The president made his personal statement, his statement about his own personal views, a couple of days before the NAACP made its announcement. Was the timing related in some way?
Not really and really. Not really, because we did this at our quarterly board meeting. That's been set a long time ago. We're going to meet on that day, and nothing President Obama said would change it in any way. Yes, it did, because in effect, I think he gave Americans permission to think about this and to talk about this in ways they had not done so in the past. So it was yes, no.
To the degree that African Americans do have difficulty with this, why do you think that they do? And I do think it is fair to mention that a lot of Americans have difficulty with marriage equality, but many people, particularly LGBT activists, seem to have been particularly pained by the opposition of African Americans because they see the two struggles as similar. And even many African Americans don't agree with that either.
Well, I think this heightened African American objection to these issues, and not just marriage, but any kind of equality for lesbians and gays, is biblically based, I'm sad to say, because African Americans are overwhelmingly a religious people. Most of us are Christians. Many of us take the Bible literally. But, you know, it's hard to believe that you can take the Bible literally. I mean, there's some things in it that seem so ridiculous, you wonder how anybody could agree with them.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're talking about the NAACP's endorsement of same-sex marriage rights with Julian Bond. He's a longtime and well-respected civil rights leader. He's the chairman emeritus of the NAACP. Martin Luther King Jr.'s niece, Elvita King, has attacked the NAACP for their support of same-sex marriage, saying that neither her great-grandfather, who was one of the founders of the NAACP, nor her uncle, Dr. King, would agree with this resolution. And Julian Bond, you certainly knew Dr. King. I don't know whether it's fair to speculate about what his position would not have been, but what do you think?
It's fair to know because there's no record of him opposing equal rights for gay people. There's no record of him supporting it. The only thing, as far as we know, he said about gay rights, he used to write a column for, I think, Ebony magazine. And in a column, somebody wrote to him and said, I feel an attraction for other men. What can I do about this? And King used language to describe it as a psychological problem this man was having, because that was the current thinking of the time, that if you were gay or lesbian, it was a psychological problem you have. People believed it was something you could cure. Of course, unfortunately, some people believe that too, but you know, you can't pray the gay away. But so we don't know what King would have said. If we look at his widow, Coretta Scott King, she was a big proponent of civil rights for gay people and spoke around the country at many, many forums about it. She was right on point on this issue, and you can assume, but you can't know, that he would have been the same way.
Do you feel that the NAACP's stance here will be persuasive to African Americans who have been skeptical? And what would your argument be? I don't know if you've actually had these arguments or discussions with other people on the board who have not shared your own personal views on this, or leading members of the organization.
Well, you know, this was the first time the NAACP board had been faced with this issue, that is, asked to make a position. Are you for it or against it? Our chairman, Rosalind Brock, called for an executive session, so it was only board members in the room. There are 64 of us. We had a speaker who sort of set the issue, this is what the issue was, and he was careful to say, this is not a religious question, this is a legal question. Do you believe in fairness and justice, not do you believe in the Bible? And then there's about 45 minutes of questions and statements. And two, I remember particularly, a young man, a college student. We're the only civil rights organization that reserves seats for college students on our board of directors. He said, if I voted on my faith, I'd vote against this. If I voted on the law, I'd vote for it. And then a minister, an older man, said, as a way of explaining how he was going to vote, I'm ashamed that I've been for most of my life part of an institution that kept women from playing major positions. And it was almost as if he said, I'm not going to make that mistake again. And when it came down to a vote of the 64 of us on the board, two voted no, and everybody else voted yes.
When it comes to the question of the comparison of the struggle for equality and dignity for African Americans and also for women, people who oppose same-sex marriage, right, say that there's a difference, that those are biological realities that can't be changed, where they believe that same-sex attraction is a behavior that can be controlled, and they feel it should not have the same standing. What is it that animates this profound belief?
It's part of that. It's part of ignorance about what the latest science is and lack of knowledge that the man who validated these cures, these so-called cures, has repudiated his validation of them, have said he was wrong, he made a terrible mistake, he's so sorry, you know, it hurt many people, he wished he hadn't done it and he wouldn't do it again. But it's also, I think, just a feeling that these people are not like me and there must be some reason for it, and it's because they've chosen to be not like me. But they never think of the opposite. Have I chosen to be like me? Is this a decision I made? Did I wake up in my mother's arms when I was a brand new baby and said, I'm going to be straight? Of course not. Nobody says that. But some people apparently believe that, and I just can't tell you how wrong they are.
There are those who have argued that African Americans, the fact that we have an African American president in the White House, notwithstanding the fact that African Americans have achieved leadership positions, you know, throughout kind of the political structure of the country, still feel that there are so many disparities, you know, health, education, and the criminal justice system. There's some who feel the priorities of African Americans are not getting the attention that they still feel it deserves. And it's, I don't know how to describe it. Maybe that the thunder has been stolen by another group. And I just wonder if you've heard that point of view expressed.
I've heard that, and in some way I share it a great deal. But I like to think that Black Americans are big-hearted enough that there's room in our concern for everyone, and that we are open to the problems other people face. Where they're similar to ours, we can adopt them, we can embrace them. So I've often felt, why are you paying attention to those people? What about me? But I can pay attention to those people because I know those people. I'm friends with those people. I work with those people. Those people help me, and now I'm going to help them as often as I can.
Julian Bond is chairman emeritus of the NAACP. He was kind enough to join us here in our Washington, D.C. studios. Mr. Bond, thank you so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Once again. And now we turn to a very different topic. Today and tomorrow, millions of Egyptians will be voting in presidential elections. This will be the first time Egyptians will choose their president since the ouster of Hosni Mubarak. But frankly, it's the first time that most Egyptians believe they actually have a choice in who will lead their country. We wanted to get a sense of the elections and what's at stake, so we've called Shireen Tadros. She is the Egypt correspondent for Al Jazeera English, and she actually just took a break from election coverage to jet over to New York and accept a Peabody Award on behalf of her network for their coverage of the Arab Spring. And she's with us now. Welcome and congratulations on this high honor.
Thank you so much.
Could you just give us a sense of what the atmosphere was like in Cairo right when you left?
Oh, it's really incredible. It's buzzing. And it has been really for the past several weeks. I mean, you cannot drive through Cairo without seeing posters of presidential candidates everywhere. It's plastered all over the place. And in the last week, in fact, before I came to New York, I traveled around the country a little bit, north, south, east, west, just getting a sense of whether this was something that was just happening in the capital or whether that buzz was in the, you know, the outskirts as well. And it definitely was. I mean, people for the first time feel like they're going to actually have a say in who their president's going to be. And for me and you, that might be something so normal, you know, to be able to go to a polling station and actually believe that that vote will be counted. But for Egyptians, this is what hundreds of people had to die for.
I was going to ask, did you get a sense that Egyptians believe that this will be a free and fair and legitimate vote?
I think so. I think when it comes to the actual vote, there's a sense that they will be counted free and fairly. There is some monitoring, and also the very fact that we had parliamentary elections at the end of last year, and there were irregularities, but no huge, ideas of fraud surrounding that vote. I think the problem becomes after that. I think a lot of people are very skeptical about whether the military will actually hand over full power to civilian president, what kind of powers they will try and retain in order to make sure that their economic privileges and their immunity is preserved. Those are the kind of concerns that people have.
Can you tell us a little bit about the front runners? And these are not names that I think most Americans will know. So if you could just kind of broadly describe where they come from and who they are. It's my understanding that they are, in fact, politicians from the old regime and Islamists. And I wonder if you can kind of break that down a little for us. A lot of people are wondering what happened to out with the old and with the new.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, broadly speaking, you can say that for sure. There are 13 presidential candidates right now. I mean, you could say the front runners come from those two camps, loosely said. You've got Amr Moussa, who you may recognize. He was the former Secretary General of the Arab League for a decade. And before that, he was the foreign minister in Egypt under Mubarak for a decade. He doesn't see himself as part of the old regime. He says that he broke with the old regime. And he very much took a diplomatic path that was not under the thumb of Mubarak. But then you have the former prime minister, the last prime minister that Mubarak appointed before he stepped down. His name is Ahmed Shafiq, very much associated with the old regime. In fact, a lot of his campaigners are former members of the old regime or were associated in that way. And then you have, on if you like, the Islamist side, two self-described Islamists. One of them is the candidate of the Muslim Brotherhood, Mohamed Morsi. He's a senior member of the party. He's not the first choice, bear in mind, of the Muslim Brotherhood. They fielded another candidate, but he was disqualified. So Mohamed Morsi was one of those who sort of snuck in nearer the end of the election window. nominations. And then the last one is a man called Abdelmenem Aboulfatouh. He was a senior member of the Muslim Brotherhood. He left the Muslim Brotherhood last year because his understanding, and I've spoken to him at length about this particular idea, whether he left or he was forced out, but his understanding is that he doesn't think that religion and politics should be mixed up in this way. The Muslim Brotherhood is a religious organization. He wanted to lead the country. He wanted to be a politician. And he says that's why he left. And he's running on a very liberal, if you like, program.
We're speaking with Shireen Tadros of Al Jazeera English. We happened to catch up with her in New York, where she was accepting an award on behalf of her network for their coverage of the Arab Spring. We're talking about elections in Egypt. The voting is today and tomorrow. It's interesting because I would feel comfortable in saying that I think there's been a lot of concern on the part of Americans that the Muslim Brotherhood would sweep the elections or would have much more strength than has been the case heretofore, when this is a group that has been suppressed in Egyptian politics. But there's a new Gallup poll out saying that support for the Muslim Brotherhood is actually declining. And you're describing what's in fact not a unified movement at all.
Yeah, I mean, you know what's really interesting, Michelle? I was telling you that I was out and about last week in different areas in Egypt. I met one man who voted for the ultra-conservative Salafis, so not the Muslim Brotherhood, but the Salafis, and other people as well. His friends had voted Muslim Brotherhood. They were all voting for a secular liberal candidate in the presidential elections, and this is for two reasons. One, I think there's a little bit of a fear that you don't want over-dominance of one group or organization, because that's exactly what Mubarak's National Democratic Party was. They infiltrated everything. And there's a real fear of that. Also, they're a bit disillusioned by the lack of reforms that the Muslim Brotherhood have, you know, been able to make, given the fact that they had such a dominance in parliament since November. They don't feel they've really delivered. And there's also this feeling that, you know, we want someone with experience. And I think at the end of the day, that is what I heard time and time again from Egyptians, from the north to the south, to the east to the west. People want a president who can take them out of their two biggest concerns right now in Egypt. One, the lack of security, and two, the economic crisis.
Shireen, before we let you go, you touched on this briefly, but I did want to ask specifically about the role of the military during the election. Have they been very visible? Is the military deemed to be backing any candidates or not? What is your sense of it?
It's a great question, and it's one that's really debated in Egypt. From my perspective, I think the military has tried, at least from a sort of media perspective, to take themselves out of the spotlight during this presidential race. Practically, there's no doubt that they are supporting Ahmed Shafiq, who's the former prime minister, a military man. It would make their lives a lot easier insofar as they could make sure they could preserve their privileges and that the constitution won't have some crazy clause in it about their place. It's very difficult for the army to accept civilian oversight over their budget, over their inner workings. So they certainly want to make sure that the next president, whoever that may be, will in some way be influenced by them and they can preserve themselves. So that's definitely something that they have in their minds. Now, the question going forward is, how are they going to actually enact that? I mean, once you actually have a president in office, if it's not Ahmed Shafiq, who is, you know, very closely linked to them, how is the military going to make sure that they preserve their influence and power and whatever within the overall system?
Shireen Tadros is the Egypt correspondent for Al Jazeera English. She's covering the presidential elections there, but we were actually able to catch up with her in New York, where she's accepting a Peabody Award on behalf of her network for their coverage of the Arab Spring. Shireen Tadros, thank you so much for speaking with us, and congratulations once again on this honor.
Thank you.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, a few of my thoughts in my weekly essay. But first, what would you do if you found yourself convicted of a serious crime in a foreign country without the help of a lawyer and no way to fight the charges against you? What do you think you would do if you were locked up in a violent, stinking prison in that country where you had to fend off attacks from both guards and fellow inmates? Do you think you'd try to escape? It's a story that sounds too crazy to be true, but according to one man, it is. In 1973, our next guest says he went to Peru with a complicated scheme to smuggle cocaine through South and Central America and back to the United States. But he says that plan went wrong, and he found himself in one of Mexico's most notorious prisons. Lacumberri, also called the Black Palace, was known as a place from which it was impossible to escape. Legend has it that the only person who'd ever successfully done so was Pancho Villa. But after 2 years at Lacumberri, our next guest, with the help of his wife, managed to do just that.
I quickly shaved and double shaved, did it again and again. Then I put foundation makeup on. I put eyeliner on. I put everything on. In the middle of this, there's a knock on the door. My heart froze.
Here to talk with us more is Dwight Worker. He is the author of Escape from Lacumberri. The story of his experience and escape from prison is featured on National Geographic's Locked Up Abroad, and that episode premieres tonight. Dwight Worker, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle. I'm very honored to be here.
And let me just establish up front, you are not denying at all that you were, in fact, attempting to smuggle cocaine into the U.S.
Totally 100% guilty, shamefully so.
And why was that?
My nose got bigger than my pocketbook. I had a job, but I had a cocaine habit, and I could not earn enough money to keep myself in cocaine. So I thought, I'll have another nice adventure in South America, and I'll smuggle back some cocaine.
So the idea was for your own use. You were basically trying to smuggle your own stash back to the States. You were not trying to set up a business and blah, blah, blah.
Oh, I would have sold some to pay for the trip. And I really think this was the first time I had done this. I got busted. But I truly think that had I succeeded, I would have done it again and again and again.
So how did you get caught?
At the time, under the illusion of cocaine, I thought it was perfect. I was an emergency medical technician. I knew how to put cast on. And I decided to smuggle cocaine under a Volpo cast, which is the one you use for a broken shoulder. And I had false x-rays made. I had bills and receipts made in Spanish. I even had a false newspaper article printed saying that I had fallen off Mount Chimborazo, climbing it in Ecuador. And I thought no one would ever question that and violate a cast and break, potentially do a lot of damage to somebody. This was the cocaine speaking, the euphoria of cocaine. It can't go wrong.
So how did it go wrong?
The customs agents have a lot more experience catching smugglers than the smugglers have of going through customs. They were better than I thought.
Hmm. So you were convicted. You were sentenced to this prison. How long were you supposed to stay there? And how long was it before you realized you just couldn't make it? You were not going to survive this if you didn't do something.
I think what convinced me that I had to leave were four distinct stab wounds in my stomach, three hospitalizations, 41 days in solitary confinement, being kept castigado, that's punished, in a dorm of 400 recidivist murderers and myself. And I felt there was a real good chance I was not going to make this physically, that I would be killed. Lacumberri was built for 800 people. It held 4,000 when I was there. And it averaged about 200 murders a year.
You describe in one point where these people had been forgotten. They had been there so long, and it's almost like they had lost their human connection. If you could just describe that, if you get my meaning.
Lacumberri had to be the hardest joint in North America. To mention it on the street of Mexico scared people. It was a business. It was an enterprise. There was not enough food or resources for the people inside. They fought for what they got. At the back of Dormitory A were people who had been completely forgotten, had no visitors, were crammed 12 into a room of perhaps 2 meters by 4 meters. They had missing eyes, missing fingers. I saw dry leprosy. There were people who had been there for 30 years without seeing a judge. Surreal is not enough to state it.
And this may be, you explain all this in the book, but why did you never receive any assistance from the American embassy? I mean, you are an American citizen, and one would think you were entitled to visits from the Red Cross. You were entitled to a visit from embassy personnel. Why was the government of no help to you?
There was an embassy official, and when he finally visited me and I told him I needed help, and he said, hey, You're guilty. You did it. Pay. And I said, I know that, but I need help from the stabbings, the beatings, the extortion. And I said I was going to. It sounded pompous, at the, really, in retrospect. I said, I'm going to write a letter to my senator from the bowels of this medieval dungeon. And then they sent me back to the dorm, and I heard a translation in foul Spanish of everything I had said to him. Clearly, he had given that information, and they beat me silly, bloody. Beatings were par for the course there.
Hmm. You spent a little more than 2 years in the prison, but during that time, you met your wife, and you got married. How is that possible?
Before you're sentenced to the final prison that they send you to, they allow two visita days. And Barbara came with an old friend of mine, and I was talking with my friend, we were looking at each other, and I thought, what an interesting person, but there's no chance. I'm going to be here 5, 6, 7, 8 years. Forget it. And then they left, and then I began receiving letters from her. And in the course of the summer of 1975, we sent each other 150 letters plus every day, a letter or two. And we made some decisions from those letters.
You say that it was escape or die, and that if you didn't have a successful escape, then you would die trying. Why is that?
Mexico, in a certain sense, has a sane policy on escape. It is not illegal to try to escape from Mexico if you do not do violence to people or destroy state property. It's almost like they give you a running chance in that sense. But they have la ley de fuga, the law of escape. And that is basically, you have one chance to escape. If we catch you, we kill you.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're speaking with a man who is believed to be only the second person ever to escape from a notorious prison in Mexico. My guest is Dwight Worker. The story of his experiences and escape are featured on National Geographic's Locked Up Abroad. So you did. It involved, as we said earlier, dressing up as a woman. Your wife, of course, had to help you. When was the moment at which you realized that you were, in fact, free?
When I actually got out of sight of the walls of the prison and I didn't get shot in the back. I have no doubt that they killed many people who tried to escape, because when I was in the hospital, they brought in at least 4 people whom they had killed. For me, I didn't believe any of it until I got into the taxi cab with Barbara and we drove off. At any point, I could have imagined being shot.
How did you get back across the border? Was it not so difficult back then?
Well, I didn't have much identification. We had a few forged pieces of paper. What I did first is reverse psychology. Barbara and I split up. There was no sense for her to be with me at all. And she went her separate way immediately north, and I went southwest. I figured they'd have border checks. I escaped on December 17th, 1975, and Christmas season was coming. I had a safe house, a friend of a friend, to go to, and I stayed there for a few days. And nothing was in the newspaper for a few days, nothing. I thought, what's going on? And finally, on December 20th, there were articles in every newspaper in Mexico that someone had finally escaped from Lecumberri. And to add insult to injury, it was a gringo.
You know, fast forwarding quite a bit to the present day, you actually were able to reclaim a normal life. I don't know if I can use that term.
Sure.
A normal life. You know, you became a software engineer. You became a professor. And you actually wrote about your life 30 years ago, and then the book went out of print. Why did you decide to talk about this again? You could easily see where somebody would say, leave that in the past.
Yeah. Well, I didn't talk about it for 30 years. The publishing house went out of business shortly after the book was published, and I thought, I wanted to be quiet about it because what kind of resume did I have, Michelle? Drug addict, international drug smuggler, prisoner escapee. I had the worst resume in the world, so I was silent about it. I worked many jobs, not ever mentioning it at all. But National Geographic contacted me, and I thought, I can't make this decision myself. So I asked Barbara, the mother of our children, and Jesse, my son, what they thought about it. My son was very affirmative, and Barbara said, go ahead and do it. And another reason was we had a few copies of the book, the original book, completely falling apart, and we thought, there's all sorts of things that they left out of the book that we should put in, and we can tell the true story now because we don't have to worry about protecting people. So with some cajoling, I thought, okay, I'll tell the story now. Also, I'm retired. It doesn't really hurt my present job, although I can't say it ever did.
Well, I was going to ask about that. I mean, there are a lot of people who find, you know, that long ago convictions, or even not so long ago convictions, really doom them for the rest of their lives, even just in a psychological sense, because they just feel burdened by the fear that someone will find out. That didn't happen to you?
Oh, well, mine was worse because there was a book out with my name in it that said True Story, and then they made a made-for-TV movie. I worked for one company 5 years, and then I come into work one morning, and everyone's staring at me, and they said, was that our Dwight Worker on television last night? So I had an obvious hole in my resume that I've never mentioned. What I decided to do afterward is to become very good at a skilled technical job, computer programming, software engineering. And then I hoped they could forget about the past and just measure me by skill set. Now, teaching at the university, when they asked me, it was about 4 years into teaching, they realized my past. And at that point, I had established myself. I said to them, well, I don't recall in the forum there being a checkbox saying, have you ever escaped from a Mexican prison?
What would you want people to draw from your story? You can see where people can hear you even now. And you sound like a very nice person. You've done your time, as it were. You've raised a family. You've contributed to society, presumably paid your taxes. Okay. But you can still see where there might be people listening to you who just think this is outrageous. You shouldn't be profiting from or talking about this chapter because what you did was wrong. And I just wonder, what do you want people to draw from this?
Well, what I did was very wrong, and I didn't profit much. I would want to state this. You know, I have guilt for the rest of my life, especially. I mean, what I want to state is family stood up so much better than the ethereal friends of the drug culture. I am so grateful that my family was there for me. And I was so happy to have an ordinary life with wife and children and a job that was great, which I would have dismissed 10 years previously as how cliche-ish, how white picket fence. At the personal level, I would say that that would be the most important thing.
Dwight Worker is the author of Escape from Lecumberri. The story of his escape from this notorious Mexican prison is featured on National Geographic's Locked Up Abroad. The episode premieres tonight, and he was with us from Bloomington, Indiana. Dwight Worker, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much, Michelle.
Finally, today I was thinking about my route home. There are a couple of stretches I tend to hit where, more often than not, there are a lot of people trying to cross the street at points where there are crosswalks but no stoplight. And kids being kids, sometimes there's no crosswalk, but they're trying to cross anyway. Increasingly now, because there are new apartments going up, I also see more young working people marching across the street, carrying their takeout dinners, earbuds in place. I'm interested in which motorists stop and for whom they stop. Do they stop for the little ones all bunched up together, who all seem to be working on identical wads of contraband gum that their mothers will no doubt make them throw out? Do they stop for the harried moms trying to keep the strollers and the walkers moving at the same pace, the too cool for school teens? Even though I've been watching this dance for a while, I still haven't arrived at a unified theory of the crosswalk. I do think elementary school cuteness seems to confer a slight advantage. Teenage bravado, not so much. Young professionals, none at all. And why would that be? I think it has something to do with who's watching. Can I just tell you, it makes me think that the power does not lie with the person trying to make something happen or even the person trying to stop it, the person crossing or the motorist deciding whether to stop or not. The power seems to lie with the bystanders. Once when I was on my way to work via a different route, I saw a man in one car hit a woman in another and try to get away. But the bystanders wouldn't let him. There was no meeting, no conference call, no vote. They just blocked his path and kept him in check until the police came. They are the ones who gave the unspoken signal of what would be tolerated and what would not. So this is my theory about what really affects the hot-button issues, too. Same-sex marriage or marriage equality, if you prefer. Immigration reform or a path to citizenship, if you prefer. Amnesty, if you don't. This is my vision of why and how things will change. It's not so much because of what advocates want or opponents decry. It's because of what bystanders will tolerate. If you think about it, most of us are bystanders to the big debates of our time. A highly regarded study, which we previously reported on, by the way, suggests that only 3.8% of Americans identify as gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender. This from demographer Gary Gates of the Williams Institute at the UCLA School of Law. While many people argue that allowing same-gender marriage redefines marriage, if the numbers are true, then the real effect is not from same-gender marriages per se. It can't be, because by definition, there won't be that many of them. The real effect would have to be on how the rest of us view these folks in relation to ourselves. As for the issue of immigration, especially illegal immigration, there the numbers of immigrants are large enough that you do see changes in communities. But here again, most of us are not immigrants, legal or illegal, and most of us are affected only tangentially if we hire or compete in certain labor markets or if we depend on certain kinds of services. No, most of us are affected insofar as we calculate the costs and benefits of a more expansionist approach versus a more restrictionist one. I'm not going to predict how either of these two ongoing and powerful debates will be resolved, except that they will be eventually. It's only to remind us that there is much power not just in what we choose to do, but in what we choose to see and how we choose to see it. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.